Hey everyone, Clay here. If you like the Rotten Horror Picture Show, why not head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile and sign up for our Patreon, where you can help support the show and also follow as Amanda and myself cover all sorts of other movies. We usually do a movie a month. This year we're doing reboots and remakes. So the likes of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and The Wicker Man and The Blob and Nightmare on Elm Street and Suspiria. So if that's something you're into, we've done a whole bunch of other sets. We've done Friday the 13th series, the Halloween series, second string of Stephen King, Video Nasties. We got so many things to listen to. So head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile, throw us a measly couple dollars, and get access to all of the horror movie content and all of the dulcet tones of my voice you can possibly handle. Amanda will be there too. All right, thanks, guys. Hello, welcome to the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast, where we talk about films off the Rotten Tomato. I put my accent on the wrong word and it screwed me up. I was trying to change it up, give it a little bit of William Shatner flair, but apparently it just screwed me up there. Where we talk about films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Horror Movies of All Time list. My name is Clay, and with me, as always, except for the last episode, is Amanda. How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm doing well. I feel like one of us should have started this with the, well, hi there.
What is that in reference to?
Did you not notice during this movie there is a character who says that like 7,000 times?
Oh, is there? I thought because I give you too little credit, that you were misquoting the Obi-Wan Kenobi line, which is, well, hello there.
That's the Obi-Wan Kenobi line.
It actually is. Yeah, it's like when they did the Obi-Wan show, it was like, when is he going to say it? When's he going to say it? Like, people were waiting for him to say he did it. He said it in like the last episode, like he was saying, I am Batman or something.
Ah, I see. Maybe you give me too much credit.
That's what people have been saying, and I didn't want to relay that on air, but here we are.
That's what the public thinks.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks.
Today, we are talking about a movie called Dr. Sleep from 2019. We had originally planned on doing the extended version, because this is one of those movies that has, the extended version is 3 hours. It's got like an extra half an hour of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the only way to get it was to pay $13 to own it, and I just didn't want to do that. So I'm sorry. We did the theatrical cut. Complain all you want if that helps you. I don't care. I'm sorry.
It's Clay's fault. You can blame Clay.
Yes, please do. It is number 170 on our list. It has a 78% Rotten Tomato score, an 89% audience score. We saw this together. Is that true? In the theater?
Yeah. That feels true. It feels like a million years ago, but it also feels true.
Yeah, it does. It does feel like forever ago. I think this was one of the last few we got in before COVID hit, I think.
Yes. Yeah. I think that is absolutely the case, which is so strange to think about pre-COVID movie theaters and how much we took them for granted.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if I've said this on the show before. I probably have, because my memory of things that come out of my mouth is very short. But it really broke my brain not long ago when I realized that the pandemic started. I guess ended at this point. Well, depending on how you define ended. Longer ago than I spent in college.
Yeah.
And college felt like an eternity to me. And I like don't even remember the last 4 years.
Yeah, it is. I feel like COVID really broke our sense of time.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah.
And with that in mind, I don't know why, segue. So had you read the book? Because this is based on a Stephen King book, obviously, of the same name. And I knew the book was coming out, and I immediately was like, no, thank you. And then I heard they were making the movie, and I was immediately like, no, thank you. What was your...
to the movie, too?
Yeah. Well, before I saw it, anyway. Yeah. We'll see if that opinion has changed. But yeah, like, what was your thoughts on the book and the movie's genesis?
Well, to answer your initial question, I did read the book. My mom is a very big Stephen King fan, so I have easy access to pretty much everything he has ever written, if I so choose it, which is an extremely convenient and lovely perk of being my mother's daughter. But I feel like I read it sort of going into it like, well, what the hell? Why not?
Sure.
You know what I mean? And then when I heard that they were making a movie, because I think they announced pretty quickly after the book came out that, like, hey, this is going to be a movie.
Oh, I have to imagine as soon as he even, like, mentioned the concept in passing, they bought the rights to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So I think it was pretty fast that it was a known thing that it was going to be a movie. And so I figured, like, oh, I'll probably want to watch the movie, but I am one of those obnoxious people who likes to at least try to read the book before I see the movie version. Mm-hmm. And I really love the book, The Shining. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people, I feel like, are very divided. They love the Kubrick movie and they don't like the book so much, or they love the book and they don't like the Kubrick movie as much. But I was just sort of curious. I was curious of how it was all going to be and how they were going to kind of reconcile between it all.
Yeah.
Where you do have these very strong camps, the people, the book people versus the movie people when it comes to The Shining, and how different those two things can be. And so, yeah, I mean, when I read the book, I remember being surprised by the book and how different it was than The Shining in so many ways.
Sure.
And I think that gave me hope for the movie.
Fewer hats in The Shining.
But yeah, I mean, absolutely. But just knowing that it wasn't going to be a direct, like, and then Danny goes back and reopens the Overlook Hotel, you know, like,
well,
he literally becomes the caretaker. Yeah. And then we went to see the movie and I remember really liking it and being very impressed at how entertaining it was. It's a long ass movie, but I feel like it actually keeps you engaged when you watch it. And I think this was maybe my first introduction to Mike Flanagan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Was this... pretty sure.
I don't know if this was mine. Maybe it was. I can't remember.
It was definitely my, like, first... It was my first introduction to him, like, knowing it was him. Sure. And coming out of it. Okay. Being like, ooh, this guy's doing a thing I like.
Sure, sure. You know? Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the things that's funny about this movie is that it very much kind of feels like Mike Flanagan trying to reconcile his divorced parents. Between the movie The Shining and the book The Shining, which, you know, I don't know, kind of... Mike Flanagan puts a lot of himself into the things that he makes, I think, for better or sometimes for worse, and it's always interesting to spot.
Yeah,
but let's take a quick break. We'll play the trailer, and then we'll talk about it.
When I was a kid, there was a place. A dark place. They closed it down and let it rot. But the things that lived there...
Hello, Daddy.
They come back. Not many ride the bus this far north. You're running away from something? I'm running away from myself, I guess.
Hi. You can hear me. You're magic. Like me.
I don't know about magic. I always called it the Shining. The world is a hungry place. A dangerous place.
These people, they hurt people like us.
These empty devils, they'll eat what shines. And they noticed that little girl.
Well, hi there.
Get out of my head! Get out!
I haven't felt power like that in so long.
They're coming. Where are we going?
There's a place. You sure you want to do this?
I'm ready.
Yes, you run, dear. And then I will find you. And you will scream for years.
Come play with us forever and ever.
Dr. Sleep from 2019, directed by Mike Flanagan, written by Mike Flanagan, based on the novel by Stephen King, starring young Obi-Wan Kenobi, Lady Jessica Atreides, Kylie Curran, Cliff Curtis, Ben Tramer from Halloween Kills, the giant from Twin Peaks, and like everyone else who's ever been in a Mike Flanagan movie or TV show, except for his wife, because he didn't find a way to, you know, sneak her into this one. Amanda, what happens in Dr. Sleep?
Struggling with alcoholism, Dan Torrance remains traumatized by the sinister events that occurred at the Overlook Hotel when he was a child. His hope for a peaceful existence soon becomes shattered when he meets Abra, a teen who shares his extrasensory gift of the shine. Together, they form an unlikely alliance to battle the True Knot, a cult whose members try to feed off the shine of innocence to become immortal.
Well, not really. Did she ever say that they would become immortal? No. So they would live long and eat well.
Semantics. Well, Clay.
Very important.
It is very important. Some things you'll find in Dr. Sleep include... gratuitous Bruce Greenwood.
Always happy to see Bruce Greenwood. He, I have really come to like him as an actor over the years. I didn't really take him serious. There was a film website I used to frequent called Film Drunk that did like a whole running gag on Bruce Greenwood's website, because like the banner photo on his website was him shirtless standing next to a horse.
Oh,
and it was just like, it was just so over the top. Like,
now that's gratuitous Bruce Greenwood.
Yeah, exactly. And so I kind of always thought he was a little bit full of himself, but he is a really good actor. He's great as Captain Pike in the Star Trek movies. However, I think his absolute tour de force was in Mike Flanagan's Fall of the House of Usher.
Oh, yeah.
He plays Roderick Usher, and he is fan-fucking-tastic in that thing.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's I think one of if not the best actor in that show.
Yeah. But he's worked with Mike Flanagan a few times. He was in Gerald's Game. And is he in one of the other shows? I can't remember if he's in one of the other shows or not.
I cannot remember off the top of my head. He might have been in... was he someone in Bly Manor? I don't think so.
Yeah, I can't
remember. Anyway. Well, you'll also find Danny Lloyd coming out of retirement.
Yes, you wouldn't recognize him because he's not 8 years old now. Yeah. But the scene at the baseball park when the person who is talking about Bradley being someone who can seemingly read the mind of the pitcher is in fact Danny Lloyd, the actor who played young Danny Torrance in The Shining, who had not acted in like 40 years or something.
Oh, wow. Well, good for him.
And you can tell.
Oh, mean.
No, I'm just kidding. He's fine.
You'll also find Teeny Town or the Derek Zoolander Town for kids that don't read good.
And would like to do other things good, too.
Yeah. How are they going to learn to tell the time if they can't even fit in the clock tower?
Great question.
Yep. Homoerotic soul shotgunning.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot to meet someone. And then do that.
I was really curious how you were going to expand on that phrase.
Yeah. It's not something you see outside of college too much these days.
Yeah. Soul shotgunning? Yeah, no. It's only on campus.
Especially after COVID, not too many soul shotgunnings happening anymore.
Not too many shotgunnings at all, hopefully.
Yeah, well.
Well, let's not do that.
Yeah, let's not dive into that.
You'll also find inaccurate AA.
Yes, because you said they use their full names?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Alcoholics Anonymous.
It's not the second A if you use your name.
Right, it's taking the A out of AA.
I've always wondered, and maybe this is a reason why they don't do this, I guess. How do people who are known to the public, like celebrities, go to AA? I guess they must not. It must be something more specific, because like you can't. Like, if Bono walks into AA and he's like, hello, my name is Jono. It's like, yeah, I know that's Bono from U2.
my outsider, I am not a person who has participated in AA directly. I know several people who have participated in AA directly.
You just like to go to watch?
No, I am a family member or supporter or friend of a couple different people who have experience in that program.
Sure.
And it's first names only. So you use your real first name, but you're really not supposed to be running around using people's last names. And there's kind of like a cultural agreement of like, it's just not cool to, like, if you see somebody in the meeting, if you run into them in the grocery store or they happen to be your neighbor from down the street, but they don't approach you about it, you don't approach them about it kind of thing.
Gotcha.
So it's more of like a courtesy, like, you know, like a philosophical choice everyone is making to kind of give each other the privacy as best they can.
It's not like a Simpsons thing where it's, let's say, Lisa S. No, wait, that's too obvious. L. Simpson?
Yeah. H. Simpson, I think, would be more likely.
That's true, yes.
Well, you'll also find in this movie hat-based hierarchy.
Yeah, lots of hats. Mm-hmm. I started wondering whether or not it was some sort of ranking or officer system.
Magician's hat, leader.
Yes. That's the captain.
Fedora.
Commander.
Yeah.
Floppy fedora, old.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, you've got your berets and your fezes.
All the way down to baseball caps, which are food.
That's true, yes.
Speaking of which, you'll also find high-tech vampire soul thermoses or the next line of Stanley Cups.
Yeah, I did find it funny. You and I and a friend of mine, Travis, were watching this, and we all kind of had the same thought at the same time when they pulled out their steam furnace, which was like, what is the canning process? Yeah. Where does this come from?
Yes.
What is this thing?
Like, the decanting is fun. I get the visual and what we're doing here, but it puts in so many questions about, like, how do you... Who came up with this design? And then...
Yeah, especially when later on in the movie where it turns out that she just burps it in.
Yeah.
And then, like, because anyone who's had a younger sibling and has tried to trap a fart inside a jar knows it's not easy. So that's all I'm saying.
Yeah. reverse shotgunning it into the thermos is like how she tries to, I don't know, anyway. Since there is no magic book, I submit for your approval Magic Cat.
Yeah, I would say yes in that it is a cat that is seemingly has magic powers, but I wouldn't say it replaces magic book because the purpose of the magic book is to provide information, like expository information that helps with the solving of the problem, and so I wouldn't say the cat does that.
But the cat shows Danny what he needs to be doing.
Yeah, but that doesn't really apply to the rest of the movie, though.
Mm. Agree to disagree. I'm Team Magic Cat.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's just say one of the reasons for my disagreement is one of my biggest problems with the movie. But anyway.
Okay, we will get to that. That'll be fun. Speaking of fun, nicknames like Rose the Hat, Crow Daddy, mm-hmm. Snake Bite Andy, mm-hmm. Apron Annie, Barry the Chunk, Grandpa Flick, Silent Sari, Diesel Doug, and Short Eddie.
Yeah, we were joking before we started mm-hmm. that all of these sound better if you imagine David Lynch reading them.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do that in your own mind now.
Yes.
I have to say, one of the things that always stands out to me in Stephen King books uh-huh. are names like these
yes.
or like certain phrases
yes.
that he really latches onto. Like what was the one in Christine that they kept saying over and over again oh. that we were like, what is this phrase?
God, I can't
like
remember.
Calling people shitters or something.
Yeah.
And he always latches. And like, this is the most Stephen King character names I've ever seen in one. The
yeah.
Stephen Kingiest.
Yes.
Stephen King character names.
Yes, and you're supposed to just sort of accept them and like roll with it like this is normal and this is like a phrase that everybody knows or something.
Yeah, and it's it's even funnier that apparently it's just something that Rose the Hat does when she meets you.
Yeah.
It's just like, I'm not going to, you know what, yeah. from now on your name is Barry the Chunk, fatty.
Well, you know, spoiler for the book, but that's not Barry's name in the book.
Oh, it's not?
It's not. It's, if you change the vowel in Chunk, his name is Barry the Racial Slur.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yep. Just gonna drop that little bit of information on everybody and then see if you all go read the book now.
All right. Interesting.
To continue our things you'll find, you will also find child neglect, child abduction, mm-hmm. child abuse, mm-hmm. child torture, child murder, and child consumption.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed we couldn't work in a child murderer or a child murderer, but
yeah.
Close. What's her name? Steamboat Annie? Andy?
Yeah.
Andy the snake biter? She's youngish.
I guess she kind of works, right? I hadn't thought about it. She's well...
15. Hmm. Supposed to be 15.
She's 15, but at that point, a bunch of years have passed, so she's...
That's true.
...less of a child, but...
Now you're getting into vampire logic as far as ages go.
I mean, we're going to have to, right? Because they're soul vampires or something.
Yeah. I mean, like, is it appropriate for a vampire who is 300 but looks 17... to date a vampire slayer who is actually 17?
No. There. I solved it for everybody. No, it's not.
Fair enough.
Yep. And last but certainly not least on our list of things you'll find is questionable parenting.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Harkening back to the very first questionable parenting we ever covered, which is Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this movie is... How do you feel about this movie? I want to let you go first before I, start going.
before you come out with a really strong opinion and color the waters too much?
Yes.
Fair enough. I like this movie. I think this was maybe the third or fourth time I've watched it ever. Definitely at least the third. I always enjoy this movie and feel like it's really well done. But I don't have, like, very, very strong feelings about it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I... So we saw it in the theater with you and some of our friends when it came out. And then I actually think during COVID, I was like, oh, yeah, that movie. Like, kind of want to rewatch that. It's been a couple years. I'm curious how it holds up.
Mm-hmm.
And I rewatched it, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's still... It still works. It has its strong points. It has its weak points. But it still works. I find myself consistently engaged watching it.
Mm.
And I kind of came away the same way when we watched it the other night. I think maybe... by this point, the seams are starting to show for me a little bit. But I still think that the performances overall are really solid in it. And it's a great looking movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they pull enough of it together that it keeps me in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, not exactly the most sparkling endorsement I've ever given. But I do like this movie. What about you?
when we saw it the first time, I enjoyed it, but I had some issues with it, and I hadn't seen it since then.
Mm.
And watching it this time, I came away, honestly, not really liking it. It really doesn't do much for me. And I was... I still have the same problem that I had the first time I watched it, which I alluded to when we were talking about the Magic Cat, in that, like, I'm on board for, like, the first, let's say, 25 minutes.
Mm.
Because I think the stuff where he's in the hospice place is really good.
Mm.
And my biggest problem is I wish there was more. Like, it was... Yeah. The interesting thing about this movie is it's a... basically, without explicitly calling it a sequel to The Shining, Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, it is a sequel to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Yeah.
And famously, Stephen King's misgivings about that were kind of that Kubrick sort of took the book and made it his own thing and trimmed away some stuff. Changed some stuff around in a way that Stephen King wasn't really happy with. And this movie seems to go out of its way to include as much of the book as possible, at least until the end, which I did look it up, and the end is very different.
Yes.
And I kind of feel like this, for me, is an argument against straight adapting a book. Because, like, I think there's... I guess I don't really vibe with the vampire stuff that much, and I'm so much more interested in Danny Torrance. Basically, I wish there was more Dr. Sleep in this Dr. Sleep movie.
Yeah.
Because that name kind of doesn't really mean anything outside of that one small scene or two scenes where he's in the hospice place.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much more interesting stuff they could have done in that stuff. In that area, without having to go on, like, multiple trips across the country and X, Y, and Z, and I don't know. There's just so much business in this that I feel like it gets away from the core of what really works for me, which is this Dr. Sleep concept.
You know, it's funny that you said that you feel like this movie is a little bit of an argument against kind of a straight adaptation of a book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like what you're asking for is more like what I remember the book being.
You know, honestly, I did on my... I skimmed it on Wikipedia, and it does seem like there's more Dr. Sleep stuff in the book. Yeah. So maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe they just... Because I also... The other part that really stands out to me to being, like, kind of awkward is the gunfight in the park.
Yes.
That just really kind of comes out of nowhere. Yep. And I'm like, man, is this in the book? I don't know.
I don't think it is. I was trying to remember.
I don't think it is.
Like, I also kind of re-skimmed the Wikipedia page for the book and was sort of trying to think back to, you know, I don't know, however many, 6-7 years ago when I read it. But I think what happened was everybody loves the movie The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Sleep, the book, is a sequel to the book, The Shining.
Right. Right.
So to take Dr. Sleep, the book, and turn it into a movie that's going to acknowledge the movie version of The Shining, you had to change a bunch of things from the book to reconcile the two. And at the same time, I think they sort of made the choice of, we've got to add more activity to this to keep people engaged for over 2 hours of screen time.
I did see in the Wikipedia thing, it's one of those things where it's like, if you're in movie mindset and you're reading the synopsis of a book, especially a Stephen King book, there's lots of stuff that's going to stand out and you're going to go, well, that's pretty stupid. But if you were reading the book, you probably wouldn't even phase you.
Right.
Like,
right.
The thing that stood out to me was that in the book, a bunch of them die because when they kill Bradley and they eat his steam or whatever, he has measles.
Yes.
And so they all catch the measles and die.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's not the most cinematic thing I can imagine. I guess I understand why they changed it to, what if they all have guns?
Right, right. What if there's a national park campsite gunfight?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because this is in my notes too, just like specifically about that change as well, where, yeah, the thing is, like, in the book, it's kind of emblematic of and it's actually, in my opinion, kind of fascinating to think back, because I forget when the book came out, but it was long enough ago now that it's interesting how prescient it was in this one thing, I think, in a lot of ways, where the thing with Bradley, the baseball boy, having measles is his parents didn't vaccinate him.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure. Somebody is going to be like, I read the book and that's not true, Amanda. But I'm pretty sure the whole thing is that, you know, the true knot has been able to survive kind of based on like herd immunity to stuff. And this is this weird thing where we've started to come back around where, you know, times are changing and people's attitudes towards these things are changing and they're not prepared for it.
It is kind of funny to think about a vampire who's been around for 200 years and just, I mean, never got, why would they need to get vaccinated?
Right.
And then they come into contact with measles and
like modern day measles.
Yeah.
But again, it's not cinematic, so they have to change it, and they can't. I feel like in the movie there's the difficulty of you're trying to walk a line between how much do you show through Abra's powers or Danny's powers versus how much do the characters actually have to go do stuff and see stuff.
Right.
Because I think, you know, when you're watching the movie, if everything is just them sitting in a room and then casting their senses outward and imagining things or viewing things remotely, it's kind of inherently less tense because, you know, they're
right,
not... Yeah. They're not in like physical danger. And so I think the movie tries to actually put them in more dangerous situations by having Danny, like, you know, driving back and forth and having Abra kidnapped and all of this different stuff.
Yeah, it does in its attempt to do that. It does set off a lot of my pet peeve storytelling alarms, which another one being the fact that Danny and Billy drive to Iowa from Maine to get a baseball glove and then drive back to Maine and then down to New Hampshire, and then the girl gets kidnapped and then they start driving somewhere, and then after all of that they drive to Colorado.
Yep.
It's like, okay. This is no
preparation.
Yeah, seems like a lot of unnecessary movement that's not moving the story. So much. I mean, technically it is, but it takes too long for me to get into that. But
yeah.
And the other one is, what should we do in this scene where they have a confrontation? Okay, what if everybody has a gun?
Yeah.
And then it turns into a gunfight. It's like, oh, okay, that's... At no point before this have you established that the True Knot use weapons.
Right. Right.
And like, everybody's packing? I don't know.
Like, I buy it coming from Billy, like Danny's friend who's there with him, because he, even as they're digging up the baseball boy, he tells a story about how he used to go hunting and all of this different stuff. And it's like, okay, yeah, if you told me Billy has a couple rifles he keeps in the truck, fine. I buy that. But I don't buy that the True Knot all have handguns physically on them.
Yeah, it was just a little, like, especially since the rest of the time they seem so kind of granola-y, for a lack of a better,
yeah,
you know, not explanation or descriptor.
Not to keep doing the "well, in the book it's whatever" thing, but in the book they are supposed to be like, I think the phrase that King uses in the book is they're the RV people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he kind of is describing them as those people who are the types you would see in RVs and at RV parks, at campgrounds, where they're middle-aged or older, and they're kind of frumpy and fuddy-duddy, and like, this is what they do all the time, is they just kind of drive around in their RVs and they go from campsite to campsite, and they're not supposed to be like young and sexy or older and strange and mysterious. They're supposed to look kind of like the folks you'd run into in line at the grocery store. They're supposed to be very, very unremarkable physically.
Well, then they did a bad job casting Rose the Hat.
And Crow Daddy.
That's true, yes.
Yeah. Very good-looking people in that group.
That's interesting. It feels like Stephen King had a bad interaction with some RV people on vacation or something, and then
once he started splitting his time between Maine and Florida, just like,
yes,
ugh.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
yeah.
So, yeah, it's I don't know if this works for me overall. There are things that I was surprised that I liked.
Mm.
Chief among them being, I actually really like the recastings they do.
Mm-hmm.
Especially casting pod show favorite Alex Esso as Wendy Torrance.
Yeah.
Alex Esso, the lead from Starry Eyes, which I believe was our first wild card movie we did.
Yes, it was.
She's fantastic. She's got the voice down. And honestly, when they do that, when they were getting towards the end, I was thinking, oh man, I'm glad that they didn't like do any recreations of stuff. And then as soon as I thought that, they cut to him axing through the door. But honestly, she looks and sounds so good, you would not even know if you weren't paying attention that wasn't just Shelley Duvall.
Yeah, there's a scene, I think it's earlier in the movie when, it's definitely earlier in the movie, when Danny is sitting at the bench by the seaside.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking to Dick, and after they have their little psychic conversation, and he I think Halloran says, "We better get you back to your mom," and then you hear her yelling Danny.
Yes, yes.
And the way she is saying it, and then the camera angle turns, and she's running from the little apartment building or motel or whatever across the street, and her run, like with the way her arms move when she runs, it's so perfect. That it feels like a scene that was cut from the original The Shining.
Yeah, yeah, she nails the voice.
Yeah.
Like it's so interesting to me when you see movies or anything where someone has been cast as a very recognizable actor or performance.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't make sense, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's always, you can always key in on like one phrase, which was like the anchor phrase for them to do the impression or the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And hers was clearly yelling Danny.
Yes.
Like once she got that cadence down, like that's the anchor. Like the one that always stands out to me, there's two that stand out to me. These are two very different movies. In Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me.
Okay.
Rob Lowe playing number two, young number two.
Ah.
He clearly keyed into the way that Robert Wagner says Dr. Evil. Because he, like, that's how he starts every every line in his movie starts with him saying Dr. Evil, like Robert Wagner.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is Julianne Moore playing Clarice Starling in the Hannibal movie.
Ah.
Very similarly to Rob Lowe, her anchor phrase is clearly Dr. Lecter.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's the, like, she, that's like how she keys into the Jodie Foster thing is Dr. Lecter. Whatever that weird, like, West Virginian accent, because, you know, mm-hmm. West Virginians are weird.
Coming in hard against the West Virginians. Jeez.
Hey, hey. It's mining country. They're tough people.
They can take it.
Yeah. But, you know, it's always fun to if you can pick up on, like, okay, that's clearly the thing that they jump, the jumping off point for the rest of this performance.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, like you were saying, most of the recasting, I would say pretty much all the recasting in this is really well done, because the actor who does Dick Halloran in this.
Yes, Carl Lumley. Yeah, oh, he's great.
He's fantastic. He even sounds right.
Yeah, yeah. The one that I was really unsure of, and they really make you wait for it, mm-hmm. is recasting Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first time I saw it, thinking that they weren't going to show his face, because the way that they set it up in that scene in the Overlook, it's very much, you're seeing his hands, and they're very clearly, purposefully not showing his face. And I was like, okay, maybe that's for the best, because that's a pretty recognizable face. But they do, and he's been recast, but with I don't have it in front of me. Henry Thomas. Yes, the kid from E.T. and various other Mike Flanagan films, mm-hmm. and shows. And they've like approximated the Jack Nicholson thing without going too far over the edge with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard Mike Flanagan talking about it, and what he said was, and I thought it made enough sense, which was, you know, the Overlook is kind of an approximation of things anyway. Like, if mm-hmm. you think back to The Shining, the person who appears as Delbert Grady is very much not the person who's described by the owner of the hotel or the mm-hmm. manager. So, like, there's it makes sense that there would be some blurring of the edges a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, all right, that's good enough for me. and I thought he was pretty good.
Yeah, I also my like personal interpretation to kind of reconcile all of this a little bit in my own mind is that you're seeing both Wendy and Jack from Danny's point of view.
Yeah. So yeah, that
you're
works.
You're kind of seeing like his remembrance of his parents less than the real thing.
Yeah, especially because, you know, he says in the movie his dad died when he was 5. Is that what he says?
Yeah.
So, you know, the image of his father in his own mind could be very different from what he actually looked like.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
As the movie starts, they make a really interesting choice by giving Danny arguably the most deplorable introduction for a main character I can think of.
Yeah.
Which is getting blackout drunk, sleeping with some random woman who then vomits in her sleep and dies. And he steals her money and then leaves her child to die. Who you later on find out does die.
Yes.
Unless he's being manipulated by the ghosts. I don't know. But there's a lot of dead child faces in this movie. Which is a
Ewan McGregor trend.
What's the other one?
Trainspotting.
Oh, Trainspotting. Yes.
Yeah. Got quite a repertoire of dead baby movies.
Yeah. And I think it's it's really ballsy that they go so far with his introduction and showing how low he's sunk.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that he says at AA that I thought was really interesting was that he talks about understanding a parent that he never really knew through their shared inherited addiction.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, I think that's a very true to life concept too.
Yeah, like, oh, definitely. Yeah.
If you don't have if you didn't get to grow up with that parent, you even subconsciously, you kind of reach for anything that's gonna give you a connection to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you're generating that in a negative way, it's still satisfying some part of your brain or some part of you emotionally that wants to feel closer to that person that you didn't get to have.
Yeah.
So I really buy that. And I think like Danny's introduction as an adult is so interesting because I don't think he realizes she's dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think he's so fucked up and he's so wrapped up in his own addiction and his own, you know, he wakes up and he's grossed out by the vomit next to her in the bed. And then he himself is immediately sick. And then he doesn't really want anything to do with her anymore. Like he's the shame of the night before is kind of overwhelming him and he just wants to get the fuck out of there. And mm-hmm. he's pissed because he feels like he had money and he's blaming her. Like, oh, she spent it. That's probably how we got the coke. And he's not really,
right.
You know, he's abdicating responsibility for all of it, for the money, for if she's okay, for the baby. Like, he's just like, nope, I'm refusing. I'm just gonna put the kid here. The crying baby will wake her up. I'm taking the money because I feel like it's owed to me and I'm getting the fuck out of here. And it's very much mm-hmm. like addict behavior of just wanting to kind of divorce yourself from all of it and abdicate any responsibility and get the fuck out.
Yeah.
And I think it's, yeah, I think it's really ballsy to have him. And I also love in that scene where Dick sort of appears to him, but it's fuzzy, like he's in the background and like
mm-hmm.
we the audience can't fully see him, and it's when we see him we know we're in Danny's head, so it's kind of showing you what the alcohol and what the drugs are doing to him, like internally,
right.
what it's doing yeah. to his shining and his mind, where he's becoming increasingly disconnected from this part of himself. And you know, so we can only see Halloran as this, like, blurry outline in the background.
Shut himself off from the Force.
Exactly.
Spending all of his time out on that planet drinking green milk straight from the boob. I was going to say, I do find it funny how the ghost of Dick Halloran shows up, and he's so, like, regal about everything. He's like, oh, Danny, you're going to take the poor woman's money? And he's not like, whoa!
Yeah.
Whoa, you're gonna leave the kid? She's dead, Danny. Call the cops. What am, oh my God. He's so chill about the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. What does he say? You could leave her money. You can do that at least.
Oh, I mean, all right.
Yeah.
It's a lot more he could do at least, I think. But
I think that way of introing Danny sets up one of my favorite things in this movie, which is the scene where he wakes up with her ghost.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Holding him. And I, like, that is one of my favorite things in this movie. The way they do the dead version of that woman and the baby. And yeah. the way her voice sounds, like, she sounds almost like kind of crackly, like you're hearing her through like a bad phone connection or like a radio in the other room, like an old-timey radio.
Yeah.
And she just doesn't sound human and quite there. And she never like yells or like freaks out at him, and there's no like, look what you did to us. She just explains it to him, and it's enough to like actually make him change his life, right? Like that's yeah. the trigger moment when he goes to Billy and says, I actually need help. I can't do this anymore.
I mean, if that's not going to do it, I don't know yeah. what's going to do it.
Yeah.
When a ghost baby talks to you after its mother accuses you of killing it.
Yep.
I have to say, as far as jump scares go, the monster next to you in the bed always works
yes.
on me every yeah. time.
Same.
There's a great, there was a series of YouTube shorts that were like 2 or 3 minute nightmares or something like that, and they were and it was just like short little short horror films.
I think you sent me this one once.
I must have because it freaked the shit out of me when I saw it, where it was this this guy sleeping in bed, and his phone keeps ringing, and the phone he's like, and he keeps saying to his wife, "Could you get that? Answer the phone." And then finally, he picks up the phone, and it's his wife on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, "What? If this is my wife?" And then they pan to the other side of the person in the bed with him, and it's just like this very creepy monster face. Every time, scares the shit out of me. I got like goosebumps just remembering it.
Yeah. It's like there's that great, you know, all the like urban legends and scary stories used to tell each other as kids to freak each other out. Mm-hmm. There's there's this great one that that used to go around. I hope it still does. About the girl whose like parents, you know, she's like a teenager, like a young teenager, and it's like her for the first time, her parents have let her stay home overnight by herself. And she's at home and like she goes to bed at night and she's alone in the house and it's, you know, dark and she's hearing noises. And so to comfort herself through the night, she reaches down and lets her dog lick her hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then throughout the night, it like keeps, you know, she keeps hearing things and weird shit keeps happening, but she won't get out of bed. She just keeps letting her dog lick her hand. And when she wakes up in the morning, the dog is dead.
Ugh.
But something has been licking her hand the whole night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But who was phone?
Yes. I love those stories. And yeah, I think
they're pretty good.
This movie tries to kind of work some of those types of things in here.
Mm-hmm.
I wish there was more of that kind of thing, though. Like, you know, because you get the... Like we're saying about, you know, him waking up next to the vision of the woman that died... And then we have the magic cat that knows when you're going to pass away. And like,
yeah,
you sort of get, we edge towards those almost like urban legend-y or sort of more traditional ghost stories. But then this movie layers on top so much of the stuff about like, here are all the different shining powers you can have.
Yeah, like, it gets a little bit. It
starts to get really complicated.
Hard to follow with that stuff. I do like that apparently, it's a rite of passage as a child to go into the bathroom and, I guess, beat the shit out of the old lady ghost.
Yeah.
They just go in and close the door, and then after that, it's like, ah, she won't be haunting anybody anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so how do you feel about this whole, the true knot in this whole concept of these, I don't know, are the true knot also, is this something any person with the shine could do if they so desired? They could... become a vampire? Like, so are these shiners those who shine who are just bad guys?
Shiners, or are they like not shriners. They're not shriners. Wearing the hats.
I was gonna say that would explain the hats if they were shriners. And the little cars.
Yeah.
So are they just basically dark side force users, for lack of a better explanation, or are they really, something different?
You're really gonna stick to the Star Wars analogy.
If it works, it works.
Yeah, I guess I can't get too mad about it.
The other analogy I was gonna use was Highlander, and I think Star Wars will be easier to follow.
Yeah, that's probably true. I don't know. I don't know if it's supposed to be. I think there's clearly some level of like. Obviously they have like an initiation ritual, but it does seem to be more than just, hey, if you hurt and or kill someone else with the shine and you suck in their steam, now you're one of these things and you have to do this forever. I maybe that is it. I don't know. It seemed a little more structured than that. Like they had to offer it to someone.
Well, it's very, it feels very, like, very similar to the classic vampire thing, where it's like, well, you have to drink the vampire's blood. You have to be offered to drink the vampire's blood before you can turn into a vampire.
Right, but it sounded like there were a couple different times where either Rose and Crow Daddy, or just Rose on her own, said something where there was like, oh, well, you know, if she's that powerful, is she food, or do we make her one of us? Or like, And she says, like, oh, I was offered a gift, of the gift of community and belonging, and I could have offered you that gift too. So it does seem like something that has to be given, not just like, you know, if Abra decided, hey, I want to be evil, I'm gonna like breathe some of this in, well, and now go be evil.
Does it have to be offered, or is it the same kind of vampire thing where it's like part of the thing is they want you to want it?
Yeah, I don't know.
You know?
Maybe.
Yeah.
No idea.
But how do you feel about the True Knot in general? Which is, what, do you have any idea where that name comes from?
Not really.
All right, moving on.
Yeah. trying to think about the, again, I read the book so long ago at this point. Yeah. I don't really remember.
What about conceptually, this roaming group of smoke vampires?
Yeah.
Which, honestly, them driving around in a Winnebago kind of reminded me of Near Dark a little bit.
Yeah.
Multiple Winnebagos, I guess.
Yeah. I kind of get it. Like, I think that there is a connection, at least thematically, of if, as The Shining proposes, there can be hungry places, then why couldn't there be hungry people or hungry creatures, mm-hmm. you know? Like, mm-hmm. if a location or a spirit or a force at somewhere like the Overlook Hotel can feed on the Shining energy, then why couldn't a human do that too? Like that leap in logic doesn't seem too crazy for me from where we're starting. And I do think there, it opens up a lot of things thematically that I think this movie is dealing with that tie very much into the original about, children and adults,
mm-hmm.
and the vulnerability of kids and the trauma that adults in their lives will often inflict upon them.
Mm.
So I think it works for me. I think they're the scariest possible concept? Probably not, but I think it's more interesting to have them be people with their own free will and their own plans rather than just try to recreate, like, yeah, let's send them to another haunted place that likes to eat kids.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I like it conceptually.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think it's just my preference for it to be a little bit more localized in the story that it's telling that makes the True Knot stuff that makes me bump up against that stuff. Like I think one of the reasons that they have the gunfight is there's too many of them. There's like eight of them.
Right.
And
right.
you really got to whittle those down. And ultimately, I don't really find the confrontation at the end super satisfying. Like, I guess it, you know, it's kind of fun that they go to the Overlook, and it's kind of fun that I don't know if that's a consequence of the idea not working, or if it's just not the kind of filmmaking that Flanagan is really good at. Because like when she starts fighting Danny, I was like, this isn't great. Like, the choreography here is very stilted and weird, and the way it's shot is very kind of stilted. And then when the ghosts show up and attack her, that seemed kind of weird. Like, it just didn't feel that dramatic to me. But I mean, I don't really know what you do.
Right.
When like you were saying, you've got these people who are basically, it's like in Scanners where they have like the scanner fight at the end and they're just going like blah, and their eyes are going white and stuff. It's like, mm-hmm. that only gets you so far. What else do you do? And I don't know, a fist fight with Rebecca Ferguson, I guess, isn't the most exciting way to end this movie.
Yeah.
Or the scariest or the most satisfying. I don't know.
Yeah. And it's tough because, like, again, this is one of those places where I think in this movie you can really see the seams that they tried to sew closed between the book The Shining, the movie The Shining, the book Dr. Sleep, now this new movie Dr. Sleep.
Yeah.
Because in the book The Shining, different ghosts in the Overlook have more of a story and more of a presence than they do in the movie.
Sure.
Like, in the movie, you pretty much get, like, the little girls, you get Grady, and then you get, like, a bunch of ghosts at the end who we just sort of cycle through as Wendy is freaking the fuck out and running around.
Mm-hmm. Which, I might say, I might add, of all the things that they used from the Shining movie that they do not use in this movie, where's the guy in the dog costume?
I don't know.
That's a layup. Come on.
Yeah, come on.
Of all the things. It's like, oh, movie... yeah, there's the maze. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What? Okay. But where's the dog guy?
That's why this movie can never be more than a B+.
Exactly.
There's no dog guy. But those other ghosts that you see, like, in that final moment of confrontation with Rose, in the book The Shining, they have more of an individual presence.
Sure.
But they don't in the Kubrick movie.
Right, yeah. There's like a whole backstory about the girl in the bathtub, right?
Yeah. There's a whole backstory about her. There's a whole backstory about the owner of the hotel. Like, there's all this different stuff, like Herbert DeWent or something like that. I don't know. But there's all this other material that wasn't pulled into the movie. But then because this movie seems to lean so much, at least visually, on the Kubrick movie, it feels weird to like... be like, hey, look, it's this whole cast of ghost characters from the original thing that we didn't really spend a lot of time on in the original thing. But here they are. Isn't that exciting? It's kind of like, well, no. I mean, maybe if you read the book, you're like, oh, cool, it's those guys. But it's just a weird, it's weird to have them triumph over Rose the Hat and then corrupt Danny. When, if you've only seen the Kubrick movie, you're sort of like, I don't know, I kind of recognize a couple of these, but what, like, why do they get to be, like, why isn't Jack Torrance the one doing it?
That's a good question. You know? Those Horace DeWitt heads out there just hooting and hollering when he shows up on screen. I do want to get into the end of it as well. Mm-hmm. Before we do that, I wanted to talk about Bradley's death, which is... Legitimately disturbing.
Yeah.
Like, that you don't really see anything at all, but man, that is a really effective scene.
I will say, like, the kid actors in this movie are really impressive.
Yeah, they're all really good.
Yeah, the girl who plays Abra, I think, is excellent, but the boy who plays Bradley, like, the way he cries, like, I've heard the little kids in my life. Like, the way he's kind of crying and saying no at first, like, I have heard a kid do that when they're really genuinely upset. That sort of, like, talking through the crying and, like, gasping at the same time. And that, like, genuinely distraught. Like, it's so upsetting. And he does it so well.
What did you do to them to make them do that?
I tried to stuff them in a thermos. And they didn't want to go.
You tried to baby bird them into a thermos?
Yeah. Baby bird them.
Yeah. Apparently, when they did the first take of that, Jacob Tremblay, who is the kid who played Bradley, was so disturbing that he freaked out everybody else in the scene, including Rebecca Ferguson, who couldn't get her lines out because she was so unnerved.
Oh, my God.
And then when they called cut... he jumped up with a big smile, high-fived his dad, and then went to the craft service table for a bagel.
Fuck yeah. Is he still acting? Please tell me he's still acting.
I think so. I know he was the kid in that movie Room.
Oh,
not The Room, but the one with the one that Brie Larson won the Academy Award for.
The upsetting one?
Yeah, well, having seen The Room, I don't exactly know how much more upsetting Room could be.
It's pretty upsetting.
Is he still acting? I assume so.
I hope so. Kid's got talent.
Oh, he's old now.
Weird. He's old now? What is he, like 20?
Yeah, probably. He does the voice of Damian Wayne on the Harley Quinn show.
Oh, cool.
He was in, of course, the last Flanagan movie, Life of Chuck.
Oh,
he's in the Toxic Avenger. That's fun. I haven't seen that yet.
Good for him.
Yeah, he's in stuff.
Good.
I'm a little surprised that he was getting a lot of press at the time when Room came out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised he hasn't done more higher profile stuff. But
yeah, I think it's tough when you start that young.
Yeah.
You know, you might just want to like go have fun as a teenager and a 20-something.
That's true. He's, I don't know. He could have won an Oscar. Come on. What's he doing with his life? But yeah, that whole thing is really disturbing, and even more so when they dig him up.
Yeah.
And they unearth this just to the front of his face, and they're all like, whoa!
Yeah. And the fact that this movie like emphasizes the decaying body smell aspect of it, which I feel
Billy
like
tells that story right before.
Oh my god! But I feel like a lot of movies don't do that, right? Like you find the dead body, and everybody finds it, and they just stare down at it, and they're like, "My god, who could have done?"
Yeah, it's always the most you get is one of them just goes, "Ugh."
Yeah, ugh. Yeah.
Like once, and like kind of like grabs their nose for a half a second. Instead of being overcome by the stench of death.
Yeah, and you got Ewan McGregor just saying, "I'm sorry, Billy, I'm sorry."
Also, like, Billy...
Poor Billy.
Billy really, really puts some trust into this guy he doesn't know.
He's got a bit of the shine.
Before they go on that trip, he tells him everything. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Yeah, okay, let's go, let's do it." And, like, if I was Billy... and I was digging in this random lot and found a child, my initial thought and only thought would be, "Oh, my friend Dan killed this child and buried this child."
But if it's that far away and you know when the kid went missing,
mm-hmm.
and Dan, your friend Dan, lives in the same boarding house you do and works part-time with you, you know his schedule pretty well.
I don't know. I'd be even... That's still easier to believe than, than everything else he told them before they left.
But no, isn't part of the point with Billy is that he himself has, like, a touch of The Shining. Like, he gets... He even says, like, I get feelings about people.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's kind of how they hand wave that
away. Stephen King's shortcut for everything. Yeah. Everything in his book. Oh, no, he's got some Shining.
Yeah.
That's why he knows how to do backflips or something. Yeah. I don't know.
I'm going to start saying that about like different people I know who are good at certain things. Like, you know, she's got a little bit of The Shining. That's why she's so good at making pies.
Exactly. Yeah, I was just going to say, like, you know, my grandma. Isn't that... Wait, don't they say that in the... Doesn't Halloran talk about his mother being like, her food was always the best, and she had The Shining, but for cooking or something? I don't know.
Yeah, it's something like she makes the best banana bread or whatever.
Everybody shines in their own way, I suppose.
Yeah, she makes like the best lemon cookies.
but yeah, it's sad to see Billy go.
Yeah.
I think they should have saved Billy's death to the end and let him get axed in the gut like Halloran did out of nowhere.
Yeah, but then you would have had to have somebody axe him.
Yeah, I mean, it gives Rose something to do instead of walking through the Overlook like she's going through the worst high school haunted house she's ever been to.
I love that she is just so like, what the fuck is this dumb shit? Like, she watches the blood come out of the elevator, and she kind of raises an eyebrow and smiles, and is sort of like, oh, cute. Just keeps
going. It's like the end of, in the first Simpsons Halloween special when they're in the haunted house, and they just start talking to the haunted house and be like, I mean, you don't really have to be so showy, but the blood coming down the walls. Like, yeah, we get it.
Yeah, you got to do the thing though, right? Like the whole way they've kind of drawn people in to this movie is like, do you want to see the things from the Kubrick movie that you loved so much? Do you want to see them again?
Yeah, you know, maybe that's another thing, because like, we are so far on the other end of that tunnel as far as let's go back and do shit from the previous movie that I don't know if watching this now sits with me worse than it did the first time. Because as far as that stuff goes, I think they handle it about as well as you could.
Yeah, I agree.
But, you know, like I said earlier, when they do a, okay, we're going to reshoot the axe through the door scene, or we're going to reshoot Jack going down the hallway limping with the axe, I'm like, do we really need... I don't know. I don't know. I guess it's like, on the one hand, maybe it's going too far, but on the other hand, not everybody has seen The Shining a million times like right. we have.
Right, true. Yeah, the reshoots or kind of like fill-ins from, you know, we're going to jump back in time and we're going to look at what happened to Wendy and Danny in the recent aftermath from surviving at the Overlook. Like, mm-hmm. we're going to show you a glimpse into their lives then. And then, like, we're going to show you a quick cut of Jack axing through the door while Wendy's trapped in the bathroom screaming. That stuff actually bothered me less
mm-hmm.
than the... At the end of this movie, we've gone all the way back to the Overlook and we're going to redo. But now, like in modern day, we're just going to have the same exact kind of cues happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Like those ones kind of grate on me a little bit now. But I think you're right. You made a very good point that when this movie came out in 2019, I think we were still kind of riding the height of the wave of this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When it still felt like fun and maybe even interesting to see, like, ooh, like, they're going to go back to this thing from so long ago. Like, how are they going to do it? How is it going to be? Like, I think our tolerance for that kind of... casting backwards, I don't even want to call it nostalgia. I think we had a higher tolerance back then. And I think now that trend has just become so pervasive and so inescapable that we're all a little bit drained on it. So I definitely think I judge it more harshly now than I did when it came out.
Yeah. And what's interesting about this specifically is, did you see the Ready Player One movie?
I think maybe like, I feel like, I don't know, maybe Greg was watching it on a plane or something, or that mm-hmm. for some reason, the whole Ready Player One thing from the time that book came out till after the movie had done its thing, I was just so not on board with it. Like immediately, oh, yeah. It just like,
could not care less. Yeah.
Yeah. Was not for me at all. So
yeah,
I have glimpsed parts of it.
Well, I watched it, I think I don't know, I put it on while I was working or something a number of years ago, and it came out the year before this, and there is a pretty sizable sequence in which they go into the Overlook from The Shining.
Huh.
They do like a complete reconstruction of the Overlook, very similar to this, and I remember watching it and at the time going like, oh, that's kind of fun, because like that movie didn't bother me in this way as much as I think a lot of other people did, because like... That's kind of the whole concept of the thing, and they don't really belabor the point as much as you'd think. So it's like, yeah, all this stuff is there, but they don't have some throat as much as I remember anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have some character going like, oh my God, it's the DeLorean from Back to the Future. Oh my God, it's Freddy Krueger. Like they don't have any, they're just there, right? Mm-hmm. It's just stuff that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go into the Overlook and it's like, oh, that's cool. I guess as a level of a video game, that's kind of fun. But it's not quite as what's the South Park thing, the member berries.
Oh yeah,
it's not quite as explicitly member berries as some other stuff is. So it didn't bother me that much. But it is.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's part of it where it's like, yeah, okay, I mean, I guess I just kind of saw this in another movie.
Yeah, and it sounds more like the Ready Player One part. They're intentionally being meta about it.
Yeah.
Like the characters in the movie know that they're in the set from a movie kind of thing. Like we're not, you're not literally going back there, because even in Ready Player One, it's not a real place. It is a piece of media that they are just referencing even in their world. So that kind of extra level of like self-awareness makes it maybe a little more palatable than hey, we're just going to try and like get the audience to go along with this and be absorbed in this as we retread ground.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, getting into the ending of this,
mm-hmm.
I really don't like the ending of this movie.
Yeah. Like the very end?
Like the whole final sequence I don't love. Mm. After they kill Rose,
mm-hmm.
basically, okay, the thing that I don't love is I feel like killing off Danny in the Overlook completely undercuts like the entire point of the movie. Because like the whole thing is supposed to be about like redemption and all this other kind of shit. And it's like, yeah. So then he goes back to the source of his trauma so he can die in a fire?
Well, he can redeem himself, right? Like, he let one little kid die at the beginning of the movie, and now he's saved another one, even if it
yeah,
took the ultimate sacrifice, right?
He didn't have to stay. He could have left.
He did get
his
femoral artery hit by an axe.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
I've seen people survive worse in movies.
It's just I'm a just flesh saying, wound, like, et cetera, et cetera.
Like, I understand the idea that he is now sacrificed. It feels too, what's the word I'm looking for? Puritan to me. Like, I bump into this thing a lot recently where there is this understanding that in order to be a hero, you have to kill yourself.
Yeah.
and it's like, well, I don't know. I feel like in this particular movie, in this story, the story they're telling is yes, it's about Danny redeeming himself and saving this one child where he let the other one die.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also about him finding his own self-worth, right? And it's and I think to have him destroy the Overlook but also die at the same time really kind of undercuts that for me, because I mean, even if he shows up as a force ghost at the end and he seems to be happy about it, I don't know. But I don't know, it just doesn't sit right with me. And in the book, he survives in the book.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think this is another spot where Mike Flanagan is trying to reconcile essentially three different source texts, right?
Yeah.
The Shining book, the Kubrick movie, and the original Dr. Sleep book.
Because the Shining book ends basically like this, right? Jack goes into the boiler room and he burns the place down.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. He has to sort of struggle against the influence of the hotel on him and make the mm-hmm. choice to let the boiler explode, pretty much.
Yeah.
And knowing that he will die, but also knowing that if he doesn't stay there, that, you know what I mean? Like, he goes down to the boiler room under the control of the hotel to stop it from happening.
Right.
And then manages to sort of gather the emotional and mental strength to not stop it and to let it explode, knowing that he will then save his family.
Right. Yeah.
So this is kind of trying to give, like, I think it's trying to fix a lot of the naysayers of the Kubrick movie,
mm-hmm.
the people who preferred the book ending, and is trying to sort of appease them, like, 40 years too late, but by jerry-rigging the original Shining ending onto this movie, which
right. Yeah, and I don't
weird choice.
Yeah, I don't think it works personally.
Yeah,
I don't hate it, but I
don't love it either.
Because especially when his mom shows up,
mm-hmm.
I'm just like, why is his mom in the Overlook? the reason ghosts are in the Overlook is because they're trapped here.
But I think it's supposed to be hearkening back to, you know, when we see him sitting with the hospice patients and at the very mm-hmm. end of their lives, they get to sort of be reunited with
a
beloved person who's passed, or get to sort of re-inhabit a moment of like peace that they had.
Yeah.
And I think that's what that's supposed to be, is like, you don't have to be, you can be sad for Dan, but you don't have to be so sad for him because look, he's reunited with his mom.
Yeah, I don't buy it. I understand it. I understand doing, but I feel like it is primed for Abra to shine into his brain and mm-hmm. tell him that, like, you know, it's worth living on or something like that. Because she ultimately doesn't really have a lot to do.
Mm-hmm.
She presents herself as this very powerful being, which she is,
mm-hmm.
but her actual, you know, her thumb is not really on the scale too much as far as the story goes. And so I think having a moment where she can save Danny after Danny has saved her would be a much more satisfying way to end it. And, like, you know, especially emotionally and thematically about, like, you know, he's been literally locking all of these memories and trauma into these literal or figurative boxes in his brain.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to confront his father. Mm-hmm. And now he can finally move on with his life in the form of burning down the Overlook Hotel.
Right.
But instead, they kill him. I don't know. I don't
yeah.
like it.
No, I agree with you. I think the end of this movie was kind of a missed opportunity because I also think it would have been a lot more interesting to have him actually have to, like, really confront his father.
Yeah.
Or even have a moment, like, you know, maybe not if you're still going to have him die, but, like, if he had that moment in the boiler room and it was his father who appeared to him and was like, you don't have to be like me in this too. Like, you don't have to die here too just to be like me. You should keep going.
Yeah.
It would have been, you know, I get what, like, I do feel like in a lot of ways they tried to use this movie to fix a bunch of the stuff that either fans didn't like about the prior pieces of this little mini franchise or that King himself didn't like. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, one of the notorious things, and I know we talked about it when we recorded our episode on The Shining long, long ago, was that King did not like the way Kubrick changed the portrayal of Wendy, especially.
Right, yeah.
And he thought it was very misogynistic, and it really offended him the way he felt like Kubrick kind of stripped her of agency and power and strength as a character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think this movie is trying to put some of that back on Wendy.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's part of what this ending is trying to do, of, like, by showing her at the very end with Danny, it's like she has been his guiding light this whole time, and, like, she has sort of been the source of the strength that's allowing him to, like, make this extreme sacrifice.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not saying that I think it works, but I kind of think that's what it's trying to do or say.
Mm.
I just don't know if it's the most satisfying way to go about it.
It's not.
Well, thanks for joining us, everyone. Clay says, bad movie. Wah, wah.
Apparently, it did take some convincing for Stephen King to let them make the movie in this way, where they go back to the Overlook for all those reasons. Mm-hmm. I guess he said after he saw this, basically all of his problems with the original Shining movie went away. So I guess it was successful in that area.
Yeah, as to, it was a great audition. Yeah, for Mike Flanagan to say to Stephen King, you should let me keep adapting your stuff.
Yes, yeah. Apparently, too, one of the things in the trivia that I think is really funny is it's not exactly worded like this, but it basically was like when they were going to make the movie, when Flanagan said he wanted to go back to the Overlook, like in the Overlook of the first movie,
mm-hmm.
Stephen King didn't want them to do that because he preferred the miniseries that they made.
Mm.
And Mike Flanagan had to basically tell him that nobody watched that.
Yeah.
way more people like the movie than they do the miniseries, Steve, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Not my mom, though. My mom loves that miniseries.
Oh.
She's not on the show. But The one thing I was missing from this was at the end when Abra, her mom is like, "You coming down for dinner?" She's like, "Yep, just one more thing." I was really hoping she was going to go back into her room, and it was going to be one of those like at the end of Labyrinth where all of the goblins and stuff are just in her room, and then they all dance to David Bowie music. That would have been a fun way if it was just like her, naked ghost lady, dog face, bloody head guy, just all. Groove into magic dance.
You wouldn't have liked it if it turned out that she had the sort of Kaiser Soze bad guy turn, and she goes back up and puts on Rose's hat.
Only if she pulled a rabbit out of it. We didn't even talk about the mother. The mother who is talk about a character with no agency.
Holy shit, dude.
Who just like... Abra explains everything to her, and she's like, "Oh, yeah, okay. Well, dinner's in 5 minutes."
Yeah. Well, she's a little more connected to everything in the book. Let me put it that way.
Sure. And she's actually played by the girl who is the lead in House of the Devil, which we covered way, way back.
Yeah, I would never have picked that.
No, I didn't. She looked familiar, and I looked her up, and that was the only reason I knew who she was.
Yeah.
I am really happy that Mike Flanagan seems to kind of catch some of these more niche horror actors. Mm-hmm. Like, I mentioned Alex Esso at the beginning, but she's been in, like, I think two or three things with him since then. And she's great. I hope he keeps using her as long as possible.
Absolutely.
So that's the end of... Oh, so in the novel, apparently Danny is actually Abra's uncle because his father had an affair with Abra's grandmother.
That's what I was hinting at with saying that the mother is more tied into everything in the novel. She is Dan's half-sister.
I understand why they cut that one.
Yeah.
That's a little bit too much.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's another one of those things where it's like in a book probably doesn't even faze you. But if you're reading like a synopsis with your movie brain on, it's like, what?
I think it's falling, you know, to continue all the Star Wars analogies where it's like, well, if Abra has the Force so strongly, she has to be related to somebody who's powerful in the Force, right? Like, make it make sense. That's kind of what I think the book. You know what I mean? It's like that same logic of like, well, we have to explain why she's so powerful with The Shining and like, how could she and Danny both be so strong? Oh, wait, they're related. Get it?
Well, what that only brings up more questions for me, which is Jack Torrance like the Anakin Skywalker of The Shining world? Like, is he the most powerful force being in the world or something? Yeah. He's got two members of his family are like the most powerful Shining people in the universe.
He is a bad dad who tries to murder his kid.
Is that why the hotel wants to eat him? Because he's got so much shine power that he doesn't even know?
No, it wants to eat him it wants to use him to eat Danny.
I'm just saying, look, it's really tough right now. Look. It's really tough right now for men. And
oh my god.
If someone had just recognized that Jack Torrance had a strong shine, maybe he wouldn't have drank so much and maybe he wouldn't have tried to kill his family. That's all I'm saying.
Oh god.
Nobody asked him how he felt.
I feel like everyone asked him how he felt and then he got mad about it.
Yeah, he just not good with emotions.
Yeah, I didn't like talking about feelings.
Anyway, this is number 170 on our list. How do you feel about the placement? Would you rate it, put it higher, put it lower, take it off the list? What are your thoughts?
I think I might take it off the list.
Yeah, I think so, me too.
You know, again, I actually enjoy this movie for all of its kind of weird, you know, living in this in-between, trying to reconcile all these different things. I still think it's a pretty enjoyable movie if you like Stephen King. I think, like, you know, Ewan McGregor is charming enough that he can carry almost anything he's in.
Yeah. I don't like his American accent, though.
Really?
Yeah, something about it rubbed me the wrong way. I'm not sure what it is.
That's really funny that you're just like indiscriminately like, meh, no, don't like it.
Yeah, yeah.
But do I think this is one of the 200 greatest horror movies of all time? No, I unfortunately do not. I think it is a solid movie for what it is. That was pretty well done in a lot of ways. I don't think it kind of crests above that sort of average rating.
Yeah. You know, there are directors on our list that are probably woefully underrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Flanagan might be the most overrepresented because I love the stuff that he does.
Same.
But the movies of his that are on this list, let me just pull it up here so I'm not talking out of my ass. Dr. Sleep. Is that the only one now? Oh, never mind. Take it back. Apparently, that's the only one now. It used to be.
They took Gerald's Game and Ouija and all that off.
Yeah. Gerald's Game, which is good. The sequel to the Ouija board movie, which must be incredible. You know, it just, like, I think it was a little bit weighted towards him having his moment when we started this with his Netflix shows and whatnot. But that is to say, I do generally really like his movies. They tend to run a little too saccharine for me when you get towards the end. Like, that was my biggest problem with Hill House, was like that last episode was basically like, we drove the ghosts away because we all hugged each other, and that was the kind, you know, whatever, sure.
See, that stuff doesn't actually really bother me that much. I kind of like, I don't know. I think he's one of the only horror directors that does kind of lean more into that sort of human element of, like, you can have the horror and the nightmarishness and then have the sort of love and hope to contrast with it.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
I really liked Midnight Mass.
I loved that show.
And that was great because, like, pretty much every character got a really good monologue at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But it felt to me like he forgot to give one to the guy who was the sheriff of the town. And so, like, when the ball is rolling, like, vampires are out there, shit is happening, they go to the sheriff, and then he grinds the whole story to a halt so he can talk about how he didn't feel safe in New York after 9/11. And I was like, oh my God, what's going on here, guys? I appreciate your struggle, but come on, there's vampires outside.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's unfortunate narrative timing, but...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I probably would take it off the list as well.
Yeah.
You know, I do think it's a very watchable movie.
It is, yeah.
And yeah, if you don't give it too much shit, I think it's an enjoyable movie.
Yeah, good performances.
Yeah, the performances are all really good. Like, he casts the same people all the time because those actors are really good.
Yeah.
You know, I like that he has kind of a company of character actors.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of, like, shifts them around as far as how high or low down the cast list they go. And they always deliver no matter where they are. So
yeah, yeah, totally. And it's fun to see Hobo McGregor living under a bridge.
Yeah, yeah. As our friend Travis said, the handsomest hobo you'll ever see.
Yeah.
I think that's going to do it for Dr. Sleep.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to hit our randomizer button since we're back to... We've moved through all of our spur of the moment mini groupings for the time being.
Yes.
At least until something else pops into my head.
At least until we get back on a mannequin based streak.
Yeah. Yes. I hit the randomizer button. Beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, boop, beep, boop. And the next one might be a little difficult to watch because I don't know how widely available this is in the form we are going to watch it.
Oh.
And because we are watching Grindhouse, which is the team-up film from Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez where they each did a shorter film. They're about like just over an hour. And then in the middle, there are fake trailers from a variety of other filmmakers, which are very fun. I don't know if that is streamable currently, because it was famously not successful in the theater. And then I think they basically hit it with a hammer and made sure the two parts never touched each other again. You can watch Planet Terror on its own. You can watch, what the hell's the name of the other one? Death Proof on its own. I will have to go and check and see. Basically what I'm saying is, Amanda, you're probably gonna have to watch this one at my house, because I have this on Blu-ray, but I don't think we could stream it.
Okay.
But I'll do some research and figure out what we're working with here.
Threaten me with a good time.
Also, I don't know if you listened to the question and the mini episode that I did while you were gone, but I did kind of get a kick out of one of the questions we got was like, how does the randomizer work? And as though it was like some archaic machine that I had built, and not just me asking my Alexa to pick a random number.
You have a Rube Goldberg machine that at the end of a 2 or 3 rooms worth of convoluted contraptions reaches into a bucket full of balls with numbers on it.
Yeah, it's the thing from Minority Report.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I slide things around, and then it engraves it onto a wooden ball and rolls it down a thing.
And then bald people in a pool.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us what number.
And then when
we're
I get the ball, I go, I don't want to watch that. And I ask them to do it again.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you guys for listening. If you want to help support the show, head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile. Follow Amanda and myself as we cover remakes and reboots this year. In September, we will be doing Nightmare on Elm Street from 2010 with our good pal Wes.
Nightmare on Elm Street correspondent.
Yes, who has been on the streets. We know him from the streets, and he's coming back to the streets with us for Nightmare on Elm Street. Until then, thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks, Clay.
See you next time.
Bye, everyone.